They want to supplant Al-Qaeda as the strongest jihadist group in the world, and their social media effort is a big part of that.
The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria wages a battle for minds and bodies on Twitter. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Would you sacrifice one person to save five others? Your answer may depend on the language you use to ponder the question.
When you are thinking about it in a foreign language, it gives you a psychological, emotional distance from the problem. And then more than 40% of people then are willing to say, yes, I will do that.
And how much of an NPR fan are you? Enough to know what NPR actually is and isn't?
NPR is kind of like the Kleenex of public radio brands. People use that term to be a synonym. Like NPR and public radio are just used interchangeably.
All that and more after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. What goes around comes around.
President Obama is weighing possible military action in Iraq as Islamic fighters gain more control.
What Iraq is facing today is a deadlier and more ruthless occupation than ever existed during the U.S. occupation.
And at the center of it this time is the terrorist group, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, whose brutal offensive launched almost 2 weeks ago has left it in control of huge swaths of Iraq. In the region, it's deemed too extremist even by Al-Qaeda. And here,
these are the vicious, the worst of the worst. If they get back into the United States or in Western Europe against Western targets, I see that as the biggest threat today.
Chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security, Michael McCaul, sounds anxious. But Senator Ted Cruz cleaves as ever to his inquiring mind.
So I'll tell you a great question we ought to be asking right now is whether the Obama administration has armed ISIS, these radical Islamic
terrorists. As we, mere mortals, reel in bewilderment, here expressed by Al Jazeera America.
At this point, who is the worst of the devils, this ISIL group that now dominates tremendous parts of Iraq and Syria, or Assad, who's fighting them? Now it just seems like the whole situation is confused. Iran could be an ally and Assad could too?
But as the mainstream media dithers, ISIS sallies forth in the message war principally on Twitter. For the past year, IntelWire.com editor J.M. Berger has been tracking ISIS's digital strategy, which he says is much better honed than its extremist competitors.
ISIS has taken to social media in a very systematic way. For instance, they created this Twitter app, which was designed to broadcast their message out at periodic intervals at a very high volume. And it was set up in a way to evade Twitter's algorithms to detect spam. Both Twitter and Google have now killed the app.
What was the principal content of the ISIS Twitter feed?
They would put out pictures and they would put out information about something that happened on the ground. It would tweet hashtags in order to get their content to show up in search results on Twitter.
What kind of hashtags?
For instance, on Sunday, they were using the app to tweet out hashtag for Baghdad. If you search for Baghdad on Twitter on Sunday night, you would see a message from ISIS that said, "We are coming." They also, in recent days, have been trying to spam World Cup hashtags. They would send out messages with their content with a hashtag for the World Cup in order to try and get into that stream. And every now and then, you would see like an ISIS result in one of the top results. It was very effective, but it's also against Twitter's rules. It's a spam operation, basically, which is probably why they got shut down, not because of their content.
How long do you think they'll be shut down?
When Twitter puts its mind to it, they can get somebody to stop using their service. Al-Shabaab, the Somali branch of Al-Qaeda, had a Twitter account that was fairly notorious for tweeting in English and putting out content about their stuff. And they started live tweeting the Westgate attack in Kenya last year. As a result, Twitter really cracked down on them. And not only did they kill the Twitter account, but every time the Twitter account came back, they killed it over and over again until they just stopped trying. ISIS is planning to do a big social media push to try and demonstrate how much support it has from around the world. And that big push is going to be significantly hobbled by the end of their spam robot. So we may see an effort to reconstitute this app from ISIS. In fact, I would expect that.
Now, there have been reports this week of a
weird Twitter account that's been disclosing ISIS's secret workings as an attempt, I guess, to undermine the group. And it goes by the name Wiki Baghdadi.
Wiki Baghdadi is an account that popped up after the infighting started in Al-Qaeda. ISIS is a splinter from Al-Qaeda, and they have been really, literally at war with the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra. And Wiki Baghdadi showed up in the midst of this infighting to try and discredit ISIS. For instance, there's a big trend on both sides right now to leak audios that they claim are recordings of phone calls by one side or the other. People talking about issues that are ideologically problematic. We're talking about making deals with some of the more secular rebels or making deals with the Assad regime.
So a lot of the content has to do with who is purer than thou.
Well, the points of disagreement between al-Nusra and ISIS revolve a lot around methodology. So there's a lot of back and forth in their social networks, a lot of fighting over who's right and who's wrong and who's too brutal and who's betraying the Muslims and that kind of thing. They're trying to get people to defect. They're trying to attract local support. But ISIS is also making a bid to be really the leader of the global jihadist movement. They want to supplant al-Qaeda as the strongest jihadist group in the world. And their social media effort is a big part of that.
You know, in country after country, in revolution after uprising, we always talk about how important social media has been. And then in hindsight, it often worked as a trigger in some areas, but really wasn't ultimately decisive. Are we right to be focusing on ISIS's social media strategy here? I mean, is it different enough, do you think, to make a real difference?
Well, there's a huge amount of hype around social media use by extremists and by everybody else for that matter. Certainly the coverage this week of ISIS on Twitter and on social media has been somewhat out of proportion to its importance. There's a difference, though, between how different groups use it. So, for instance, in Egypt, people were able to kind of self-organize using social media, and that's an important development. For ISIS, it's a different factor. ISIS is trying to attract donors, and it's trying to attract foreign fighters, volunteers, to come and join them. And for that purpose, social media is a powerful tool for them.
How do we know that?
Well, you can see it happening. There was a gentleman from the National Counterterrorism Center who described this as peer-to-peer recruiting. There have been cases where you see somebody who's on there with a casual interest who gets drawn into this and eventually goes there to fight. And the whole way along their trip, they're being assisted in communicating and doing the logistics over social media.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
J.M. Berger is editor of IntelWire.com, and he's been tracking ISIS's Twitter strategy for the last year. How did you even know about this organization a year ago?
Well, it was in the circles that I travel in, it was a pretty big deal. The split from al-Qaeda in this infighting is good for us in a lot of ways. The problem is going to be at some point these groups are going to want to compete in terms of what kind of damage they can do outside of the local arena. So when they start trying to one-up each other, that's when we're going to have to really be on watch.
As it struggles against the mighty forces of Twitter, allies and enemies of ISIS wage an information war on television. Elliot Kalla is a professor of Arabic and Islamic studies at Georgetown University in Jordan for the summer. And he spent the last few days with his wife's family, who recently resettled from Baghdad to Amman. And much of their time together has been spent in the light of the flickering screen. We asked him to read part of his essay just published in the online magazine Jadalia called Watching ISIS on TV.
One government channel, downplaying the recent events in Mosul, aired loops of scenes suggesting that life had returned to normal. Pictures of people sweeping up litter and debris from streets, as well as a color piece about the local fish market. After identifying the scaleless fish for sale, my hosts shrugged. Sunnis eat that kind of fish. We don't. Elsewhere, we saw the counterpoint to this. Cell phone videos taken surreptitiously of streets where only masked men with Kalashnikovs and RPGs dared to walk. My hosts occasionally commented, "Thank God we left." One cousin got up to check Facebook to see if his friends in Mosul were safe. He returned a moment later to say that the Maliki government had shut down both Facebook and Viber. Al-Rafidain played nostalgic loops of what can only be called greatest hits. Music video clips of military kills and nationalist songs played over real-time footage of IED strikes against U.S. occupation forces from a decade ago. Humvee doors are catapulted into the sky. Trucks catch fire and roll down abandoned highways, and tank turrets are blasted from their moorings. For its part, Arakia played loops of video clips of drone strikes. No music plays on these loops. These are designed to instill the confidence of cold technological power. The screen is filled with an overlay of tracking numbers and coordinates. The image is composed of shadowy figures in Toyota trucks dancing across the desert or attempting to hide under an overpass. Then the missile strikes and we cue to the next scene. Again, my fellow watchers shrugged. This is just PlayStation stuff. For the next few hours, we watched scripted scenes of men gathering in public squares to volunteer for the fight. Groups danced and sang their promise to defend Shiite Iraq, using tunes and lyrics that used to belong to Saddam Hussein. Men shot pistols, rifles, and automatic weapons into the air in an unabashedly phallic frenzy. Channels broadcast glossy recruitment videos for the army. We watched scenes of brave professional soldiers saluting the flag and then boarding helicopters that flew across the country. They deploy across golden fields of wheat, facing an enemy who never appears before the fade-out. One cousin shook his head. These were the guys who just ran away. We listened to a bombastic martial ballad performed by a full orchestra and a chorus of men and women wrapped in the Iraqi flag. The lyrics praised the steadfastness of the army and the people and promised that ISIS would be destroyed. They actually mentioned ISIS, Daesh, by name. We wondered how they had managed to compose the song and then get 70 people to perform it and then film it and broadcast it all within 1 or 2 days. One of my hosts pointed to the screen. Look, look, none of them are actually singing the words. Sure enough, the singers were singing something, but clearly not the words of this song. At some point, my wife's cousin went into the kitchen to fix some cardamom tea. Then she brought out a delicious watermelon. We eventually decided to watch an American movie playing on NBC. It's really remarkable to watch Tom Cruise in Risky Business. He was so young back then.
Kala says the sprawling array of Iraqi television stations can be traced back to 2003, when the U.S. occupation spread cash and a capitalist ethos across Iraq's media landscape.
You saw the deregulation of a very restricted and authoritarian system. We saw privatization and explosion of the freedom of press. In fact, Iraq was a model for media diversity. In 2003 and 2004, it was arguably the freest media in the Arab world and maybe the freest media that had existed in the Arab world. Lots of people wanted to come in. And what we saw was a real free-for-all, complete competition. And competition, of course, was considered success. But deregulation also meant the removal of oversight. When you add to that, like, the emergence of satellite channels that can't be shut down, add to that a disintegration or fracturing of Iraqi society and the rise of sectarianism, and then you begin to see something probably never intended, a huge polarization and fragmentation of the media.
Applying American principles, we say generally that we defend the speech we hate.
Right. Absolutely.
But?
The but here is you are what you watch. And as the political situation in Iraq begins to deteriorate, people start to tune into those channels that reinforce their worldview. And this simply begins to reinforce the kind of polarization and fragmentation in society. No one knows what is happening, which is why we're watching. And at the same time, the images and the stories that are being broadcast are not actually information, right? And so they're not going to teach you anything. They are only going to mobilize what you already think about what probably is happening. Everyone I was watching it with was commenting. And that's true in the Arab world and probably true everywhere. Audiences are not passive. And what I'm hearing is a very tired but also sectarian point of view, which is to say, this is a war on Shiites. It has its roots in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Syria, and in fact, the entire Arab world. And at the same time, the Shiite leadership is corrupt and self-serving. You don't see any discussion of why might Sunnis be so thoroughly alienated from the central government that they would, in some cases, join ISIS, in other cases, passively accept them. In the absence of any station that's able to step above this, I think it'll take a long time for that to ever be articulated on mainstream Iraqi media, which at this point is almost entirely Shiite.
Eliot Kalla is a professor of Arabic and Islamic studies at Georgetown and author of the crime novel Baghdad Central. Coming up, should death threats be prosecuted if the threatener said he didn't mean it? This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by LegalZoom. According to Forbes.com, approximately 543,000 new businesses get started each month. If you're thinking about starting a business, learn how LegalZoom can help with DBAs, LLCs, incorporation, trademarks, and more at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom provides self-help services and can connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. Enter OTM in the referral box at checkout for a special discount for On the Media listeners.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case that could have a profound impact on how violent speech online is viewed in the eyes of the law. The case involves Anthony Ilonis, a Pennsylvania man serving jail time for posting death threats against his wife on Facebook. Ilonis said he didn't mean it literally, and it's up to the High Court to decide if that distinction matters. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the law for Slate, and she says the jury was given very clear instructions as to how to judge the Ilonis case.
Generally, you know, all sorts of speech is protected, but the courts have always carved out this one little thing called true threats and said, hey, if you're really, truly threatening to hurt someone, then it's not protected speech. So what the jury was told is that the standard for whether it's a true threat is whether a reasonable listener would objectively think that the statement is really a threat. And so they sent him to jail for 44 months.
He wrote about smothering his wife with a pillow and dumping her body in a creek so it would look like rape. The text of another message read, I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess, soaked in blood. Ilonis always claimed that he never intended to carry out any of these threats, that he was writing rap lyrics and his free speech had been violated.
He just claims that this was therapeutic. He was deeply depressed. She had left him, taken their children. He is very, very clear that this was homage, you know, art and a tribute to Eminem. And his argument is, just to go back to the test that the court uses, that whether she objectively was afraid shouldn't be the determinant here. In his view and in the view of where he wants to push the law, the test should be his intent, not her experience of fear.
He did post some disclaimers among the writings, right? Suggesting that this was more art than threat.
Right. At the same time that he was saying the things that he was saying about wanting to hurt her, he was also saying art is about pushing limits. Quote, I'm willing to go to jail for my constitutional rights. Are you?
What is the Supreme Court being asked to decide?
They're being asked to clarify a test that they laid out in a 2003 case about cross-burning and whether cross-burning was unprotected speech because it constituted a true threat. The court said it was not a true threat. It was, in fact, protected speech. The one dissenter, by the way, was Clarence Thomas.
Right.
The 2003 decision, I think it's fair to say, is not completely clear. And I think the test determines the outcome. If you're going to ask people like Ilonis, did you really mean to threaten to kill and rape her? The answer is probably going to be no. Alternatively, he argues, and I think it's a very compelling argument as a First Amendment matter, he doesn't want to be at the mercy of every single person who hears something he posts and takes it out of context. In other words, the internet changes everything because without being able to look in his eyes and know what he's saying and understand the context, everything can look like a threat. And are we really going to have to be subjected to the idea that the test is, was someone alarmed?
But given recent events like the shooting in Isla Vista, where Elliot Rodger detailed his plans to murder people online, I guess there's a particular urgency around assessing intent, taking online threats seriously, and grappling with the issue.
That's right. And one of the things that's interesting in the case is the Justice Department comes down on using the sort of reasonable listener standard. The Justice Department says, we're not going to take the word of the threatener. We're going to try to protect people from the fear and terror of being threatened. And I think that there's a valence around this case that hasn't fully emerged yet in the media, but is starting to emerge, where a lot of the women who reacted to Elliot Rodger are starting to talk about this case as a way of thinking through the issue of how do women experience threats online, and that this case in a way is as much a gender case as the cross-burning case was a race case.
And on the side of the defense, the use of rap music, a cultural form and a milieu that the Supreme Court justices are not familiar with, is going to constitute perhaps a racial argument on the other side.
Absolutely. I link in my piece to a really fabulous column in Forbes by three law professors who are defending Alonis, who say that it is a routine thing for people to be prosecuted and harassed based on rap music. And so I do think, in a way, the other thing that's at issue in this case is that he was using an art form that is highly controversial and arguably using it in an artistic way and a therapeutic way. And the idea that the court's going to get involved in whether, you know, that's legitimate or not further, I think, confounds this case.
So a bunch of principally old white male justices are going to be adjudicating an issue in which there are both gender and racial stakes. So what will be the outcome for the public, depending on how the Supreme Court comes down on subjective intent?
You know, it's either going to sweep in an enormous amount of protected speech, which will be bad for the First Amendment, or it's going to protect a lot of really awful, hateful speech, which will be bad for listeners. But I think Justices Stephen Breyer, Sam Alito, Clarence Thomas have been waiting, in some sense, to dive into a case about how the internet changes everything. There is this burgeoning notion among some of the justices that you have some kind of right to be left alone. Both Alito and Justice Thomas have written really passionately about their fear that the internet makes us all very vulnerable to the craziest person who's stalking us. And so I think that may play out in interesting ways in this particular challenge.
Dahlia, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the law and the courts for Slate. If words matter, then naturally it follows that language matters too, especially when it comes to solving a moral dilemma. That's according to a new study authored by University of Chicago psychology professor Boaz Kesar and Albert Costa, a psychologist at Barcelona's Pompeu Fabra University. They found that your decisions can change radically depending on whether you reach them in your native tongue or in a second learned language. In his research, Boaz used a classic social science hypothetical. Imagine you're standing on a footbridge. An out-of-control trolley passes underneath, hurtling towards five people who will die unless you stop the trolley by dropping a heavy weight in front of it. A very large man stands beside you. Do you sacrifice him to save the other five?
Right. So we did not invent that. A lot of research shows that most people don't want to push the man.
Only about 10 or 15% of people would actually throw the man out in order to save the five others?
Exactly. That's been documented in dozens, if not more, of experiments. They viscerally cannot do it, even though they can make the calculation, you know, basically, they'll save five people.
And that's when you're asking people in their native language.
Exactly.
But when you ask people in a foreign language, one that they understand but isn't their natural tongue, things change radically.
And that's exactly what we predicted. When you are thinking about it in a foreign language, it gives you a psychological, emotional distance from the problem. And then more than 40% of people then are willing to say, yes, I'll do that.
Now, Albert, while Boaz was doing this in Chicago, you were doing an almost identical study in Barcelona, totally by coincidence.
Right, right. We didn't know each other at that time. And then one day I call Boaz and I said, look, we have these weird results. And then before I finished the sentence, Boaz said, well, I know what you have. How do you know? So what you have is that people push more the large men off the bridge in a second language, in a foreign language. I said, yes, that's right. So we joined forces and we had different samples. And it's a very strong, experimentally speaking, a very strong report.
Now, it's my understanding that a truly bilingual person would have the same kind of emotional resonance in both languages. Is that true?
Right. People that have learned the second language in the context of social relationships, these people are going to use the second language, emotionally speaking, in the same way as the first language. Okay. And indeed, in our sample in Barcelona, whether you were Spanish as a first language or Spanish as a second language, but having learned that second language very early on in life, did it make a difference?
I'm not a native English speaker. And I had the sense that I make decisions differently when I use English than Hebrew. When you use a foreign language, you have a different reaction to the words, especially emotionally laden words. A lot of moral dilemmas, the decision involves an emotional reaction. So we figured reducing the emotional reaction by using a foreign language might lead to a different decision, a different choice.
But can you prove that? Or is it simply that they're working harder to understand the problem in the non-native language, and since they're taking extra time and don't respond reflexively, maybe that leads to more logical thinking?
In our previous study, we ran an experiment in which we asked participants to solve some logical problems that did not involve any emotional component. So you have a baseball and a baseball bat that together cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost?
You say 70% of the people, among whom I am, would assume that the ball costs 10 cents, but it's wrong.
People respond 10 because it's an intuitive response that comes to mind quickly, right? So it's obvious that it's 10, but it is not. Now, when we present these problems in a foreign language, people didn't respond better to those problems. Now, if it's only a matter of working harder, the fact that we didn't find the effect there, well, suggests that to some extent emotion is involved in driving these effects.
Boaz, you also looked into the effect that thinking in a foreign language has on risk-taking, and you found that people are more likely to gamble in a foreign language. Why would people take risks if they're thinking more logically? What am I missing here?
We actually looked at risks that are worth taking.
Oh, those.
You know, we take risks all the time. So how about I offer you $100 in your hand, or we'll flip a coin and I'll give you $10,000 if it's heads or nothing if it's tails. Would you take the risk?
The logical thing would be for me to take the 50-50 chance that I could get $10,000.
Yeah, assuming that $100 is not going to make you or break you, then yeah, you would take it. So we gave people $20 and we said, we're going to play a game now for real, 20 rounds. Each round you take a dollar and you either put it in your pocket or we flip a coin, and if it's heads, we'll give you $250. If it's tails, you get nothing. And you do it 20 times. If you're an economist, you would take all the bets. On average, you'll come out ahead. But people don't like to do this. People hedge their bets. So people take about 50% of these bets.
But in a foreign language, they took more.
They took about 70% of the bets. They operate with a little less fear of losing the dollar. In a way, they're less inhibited by their fears.
So, Albert, what do you think? Should we always think about difficult problems in a foreign language?
Well, sometimes to take decisions driven by emotion is important. We don't want to appear like saying the logical options are always the good ones. I mean, sometimes you have to go with your gut feeling, and that's correct. So this depends on the problem. Now, for, say, financial problems that companies may have, it would be good to have a group discuss the issues in a foreign language and the other group discuss the issues in a native language and see whether they reach the same decision. In those situations, speaking in a foreign language would help to make decisions more accurately.
Is there anything in your own life that you wish that you had considered in your second language rather than your first?
Fights. You say things you don't want to say. So when you fight in a second language, perhaps you can have some psychological distance that allows you not to say things that you will regret later on.
All right. So this is my life. I live in English, but my native tongue is Hebrew. And my wife and I are celebrating our 25th anniversary this August. And maybe we are able to do this partly because in our fights, it's much easier for me to say, "You're right."
In English.
Because it's in English, exactly.
Boaz Kesar is a psychology professor at the University of Chicago. Albert Costa is a psychologist at Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
They are both authors of the study, Your Morals Depend on Language. Coming up, what NPR is, what it isn't, why you probably don't know the difference, and why maybe you probably should. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Late last month, NPR announced that for budgetary reasons, Tell Me More, a one-hour daily news and talk show, would be off the air come August 1st. The show has struggled over its seven-year run. The listenership was tiny, and it was costing NPR more than $1 million a year. But the demise of Tell Me More revived long-standing concerns about diversity at NPR. It's the third show geared toward an audience of color canceled in the last decade. Or, as Verilyn Williams put it in a piece for Ebony Online, the shuttering of Tell Me More marks, quote, the end of NPR's blackest show. As a public radio producer herself, Williams had some questions for Keith Woods, NPR's vice president for diversity in news and operations. So we brought them together. Verilyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
And Keith, welcome to you too.
Thank you, Brooke.
In an NPR report on diversity, it was stated that it's important for the news organization to sound like America. That was something that particularly caught you, right, Verilyn?
Yeah. And I would argue that sounding like America means that diversity is institutionalized, and it's not just segments that air on NPR programs. And Tell Me More was hosted and produced by a woman of color. It covered diverse topics 5 days a week, and Michelle Martin had editorial control that I don't really see happening across public radio for the most part. How will NPR fill the void that Tell Me More's canceling is going to leave?
I feel pretty certain that some of the parts of storytelling, some of the parts of imagining the stories that we are going to tell will carry on. Lynette Clementson, who is an African-American woman, now tasked with helping to create this new presence for Michelle, is also at the director level in the organization. And if you spent any time at all with Michelle Martin, you know that you don't have to worry too much about her voice not breaking through.
Well, I started on Radio Rookies here at WNYC. I've interned a bunch in public radio. Then I went from interning to freelancing. One of the things that I've learned specifically as a freelancer is that even though producers or senior producers may have the best intentions, there is a level of control that you lose in that process. I guess my fear is that the more segmented a person like Michelle Martin is, the more watered down her perspective is going to be.
Let's say up front that you can't say that the end of that show with 5 hours of programming a week, when it goes away, doesn't take something with it. Having said that, though, the platform that Michelle gets, again, you know, NPR has this to prove, But I think with the amount of weight behind her from the top leadership down in the organization, we're going to see something different than we've seen at any other time at NPR. We have an opportunity there to do something very special and very different.
How many people of color are involved at high enough editorial levels to actually direct reporters in one way or another?
You probably have a substantial cadre of black leaders in particular at NPR at some significant levels. National editor, executive producer, two directors' positions, Audie Cornish as a host of All Things Considered. Arun Roth on Weekend's All Things Considered. You look at the range of people there, and there's reason to say, yay, you know, we've been successful in some ways. The one thing in just 4 years of being at NPR that I know is that, you know, when you suffer setbacks, you get up and you move forward again.
After the layoffs that ended Tell Me More, non-white staffers made up 22.7% of the NPR newsroom, according to NPR. That's a lot better than the average of non-white radio journalists, which was 11.7% of newsrooms in 2013, so nearly twice as much. NPR's audience is calculated to be 87% white, and Michelle Martin's audience for Tell Me More was 80% white.
If diversity is a goal of NPR's, 7%, some people would be like, it's just 7%, Marilyn. But that is trending towards your goal. When it was decided that Tell Me More would be canceled, was that ever brought up? Like, what was that conversation like?
Well, sure. It was at the center of the conversation. And I think we fully understood that it's a show that doesn't simply add a broader range of diverse voices to the air. It filters the world through a different set of filters. So you have a particularly interesting take on just about everything, whether we're talking about, you know, Beyonce 101, which was one of the more recent pieces, or you're talking about the crisis in Iraq. And I think that you have to look at the things that were the very best about that show and dedicate yourself organizationally to seeing to it that we're able to achieve that. Because we're looking at a bigger audience and perhaps ultimately a bigger impact.
I think we can all see the value of bringing her voice to millions of people in the tentpole shows.
Right.
But how would you assess what we're losing by not having Tell Me More?
The ability to spend exclusive time on ideas that are filtered through that lens of difference that the Tell Me More crew represented. When you talk about what's lost, it is the frequency of that happening because there's a show. But I don't believe we'll lose the perspective that grew out of the Tell Me More table. It will be different because there are going to be fewer people around it.
Just also the cultivation of people that Tell Me More brought, you know, was huge for me because it showed me what the possibilities were.
Michelle was getting voices on the air, sources on the air who made their way ultimately to other places at NPR who might not have made it there but for the fact that they came in through Tell Me More. But it is up to us organizationally to take the load off the shoulders of a single show or a single person. And that is also a piece of the work that we have underway at NPR right now. And we will have to wait to see how we do over time.
How have you dealt with the public relations part of this? Now, I know Tell Me More didn't have a lot of listeners. And part of that is because of its placement by local stations, all of whom get to choose where they put it. The other reasons, we can only project what they might be. Nevertheless, the National Black Church Initiative, which is a coalition of 34,000 churches, asked members and parishioners to refrain from donating to NPR, which fundamentally means donating to local stations, because, quote, NPR has abandoned the African American community. We cannot be expected to donate to a station who has failed minority voices in America.
we're an organization that has to make difficult decisions like so many other news organizations have. In context, NPR still has been one of the most stable news organizations and very much the beneficiary of a public that understands the relationship between their money and our work. So we have to make difficult decisions. We have to deal with the fact that when we do that, there'll be people like the Reverend who wrote that letter who disagree with our decision. I think that our public very much understands the realities of being a media organization in 2014. We can't say that it doesn't hurt when we have to close a show, but it is not the end of the world for the work that someone like Michel Martin is trying to do.
Assuming that NPR had to end Tell Me More to address its deficit in 2014, do you think that NPR was doing enough in 2011 and 2010 and 2005? Is this a symptom purely of a momentary shortfall in a bad time? Or does NPR have some making up for lost time to do?
What makes answering that question difficult is that if you go back to 7 years ago when the show started, what you would find is an incredibly changing cast of characters year over year over year who have had significant roles in seeing to it that anything that we did rose or fell.
What Michel Martin calls executive churn.
Churn, sure. Each of those events was a different event, but the consequence is the discontinuity that kills broader diversity efforts in the organization, or had, and did not do well by Tell Me More particularly, because I think the kind of work that we might now understand would need to be done over many years wasn't done at the level that it could have been done. Why was that? Is it institutional? I'm hard-pressed to say yes to that. But mostly because what is institutional at NPR is individuals, and we have had so much change. But we do know we could have done better.
Is this a weird position to be in, Keith?
What makes you say that, Brooke? You know, look, I came to NPR because I believe in what public radio does, the kind of journalism that we all should be aspiring to in the profession. And NPR offered to me through this particular work the opportunity to have a hand in changing not just the journalism, but changing the way that the consuming public understands the issues. And any awkwardness that I might feel being in a position here of defending a decision that we've made to close a show that is very much about that effort, any discomfort that I feel about that is overshadowed by the opportunity that I still believe exists here to do that kind of work.
Keith, thank you so much.
Thank you, Keith.
It's my pleasure. And Verilyn, nice to meet you. And Brooke, great to talk to you again.
Same here.
Same here. And Verilyn, thank you too.
Thank you, Brooke.
Verilyn Williams is a social justice journalist and communications organizer at the Brooklyn Movement Center. Keith Woods is NPR's vice president for diversity in news and operations. This week, BuzzFeed had a listicle titled 29 Things Only People Who Work in Public Radio Will Understand. Number 15 is, you ask for a pronouncer for even the most simple names, just to make sure. Number 27 is, you've accepted the fact that your hard work helps some people fall asleep. And number 18 is, you're sick of explaining to people the difference between NPR and local public radio. But we've decided to take a stab at that one, if only because OTM producer Chris Neary actually wants to explain.
I've had a full-time job in public radio for a few years now, but it took a long time to get. So sometimes when I see someone I haven't for a while, they'll say something like, it's great you got that job at NPR. Or knowing what I'll do, they'll say, I heard this great story on NPR today. And then recount something that was on Marketplace or This American Life. I smile and nod usually, but here's the thing. I don't work at NPR. Nothing you hear on Marketplace or This American Life is on NPR. Here's Seth Lind. He's the director of operations at This American Life.
NPR is kind of like the Kleenex of public radio brands. Like, it's NPR and public radio are just used interchangeably by people.
NPR is not a radio station. It's a building in Washington, D.C., with bureaus and other places, with administrators and coordinators, technical development and PR staff, and the people who create Morning Edition and All Things Considered and other shows. National Public Radio was born in 1970, but local public radio stations were broadcasting decades before that.
Every station is its own organization, and they take content from multiple distributors, NPR, APM, which is American Public Media, PRI, PRX, and, you know, anyone else who's just independently distributing a show.
On the Media is produced in New York City at the country's biggest public radio station, WNYC. That's who pays our salaries here at OTM. We work mostly out of a building in Lower Manhattan, far from Washington, D.C. Anyway, I've talked to friends who, it's pretty clear, believe that WNYC is in some way owned or controlled or something by NPR. Here's WNYC Vice President for Content Production and Development, Chris Bannon.
NPR doesn't own any stations. In fact, the stations, you could argue, own NPR. NPR is a membership organization. The stations are the members. There is someone called an A-rep at every station. That person votes on major issues that are brought forward to the membership by NPR and NPR's board.
So stations are voters, but they're also, weirdly, customers of NPR.
Every year they come back to each station and say, would you like our fantastic news magazine show? And we're going to charge you this price based on your average listenership. So it's supposed to be a fair system that is based on the amount of listening that's done relative to the size of each market, so that a station in Alaska isn't paying the same fee as a station in New York City, which would break the station in Alaska, and it would be probably unfairly low for the station in New York City.
It wasn't always this complicated. I talked to Brooke, who covered public radio way before becoming a host.
Back in 1983, NPR was trying to increase its independence from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, public broadcasting's federal funding arm. It was getting about 50% of its money from CPB at that point, wanted to reduce it way down, and tried a whole bunch of ventures, all of which failed miserably, resulting in a shortfall of somewhere between $7 and $9 million.
As a result of NPR's budget crisis, Congress redirected the vast majority of the money they had been giving to NPR to local stations instead. That way, stations could choose to pay for as much NPR programming as they wanted.
It made NPR presumably less powerful and empowered the stations more. Maybe this was an opportunity leapt upon to make NPR less important. But honestly, I think this push to send the money around the country was not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. People were just really frustrated.
As lawmakers' frustration forced a shift in power from NPR in Washington back to the local stations, those stations increasingly began to flex it. The first public radio distributor to really compete with NPR was launched by Minnesota Public Radio, after NPR declined to distribute its local old-timey radio show.
It's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown.
After the success with Prairie Home Companion, other distributors, including big local stations, began to market their own national shows. So when you hear
On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR, what that means is that WNYC owns and produces the show and licenses it to NPR, which distributes it to the public radio stations, collects fees from those stations, takes a cut, and then gives the rest back to WNYC to pay to produce the show. Simple, right?
But the thing that makes this also confusing is that it's not just that there's all these myriad public radio-making, acronym-having institutions. It's that sometimes they make it, sometimes they distribute it, sometimes they join forces with other acronyms and split those responsibilities.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On
Listening
Point.
To The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Catherine.
WGBH Boston Public Radio.
On Being is distributed by American Public Media.
It's just blah, 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 blah to listeners.
Eric Newsom is NPR's vice president of programming.
They don't really understand the distinctions, which I think is offered in an attempt to be transparent and clear, which is good. But I think the net effect is it just creates more confusion as to what all this alphabet soup really is.
So does it matter if you know which cafeteria is serving up your public radio meals? Sort of, yeah. The best reasons for public radio to be clear about who is making what are, one, knowing who to yell at when you hear something you hate, and two, knowing who to praise when you hear something you like. That said, I almost never correct my friends, even though I work at a show that regularly hammers other media for lack of transparency. It's hard to explain without sounding like you're lecturing. Here's Sean Cole. He's a producer at This American Life and a contributor to 99% Invisible, which is part of the podcasting network, Radiotopia.
I remember going through security at the airport at one point, and I'm putting like my bags through the, you know, x-ray machine, whatever, on the conveyor belt. And the guy on the other side is like, microphone in there. And I go, yeah. And he goes, are you a singer? And I was like, no, I'm a reporter. And he goes, for NPR? And I go, basically, yeah. And he high-fived me. So if I had, like, gotten into some conversation and corrected him, I wouldn't have gotten a high five. Sometimes it's important to just go with the flow.
For WNYC's On the Media, I'm Chris Neary.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, and Mira Sharma. We had more help from Andrew Chug, and our show was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippin. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Now you know what that means. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.